It's been very hard for me to continue to hear people deny what happened on October 7th, the atrocities that Hamas committed. And I wasn't there. I heard about it third hand. I heard about it from my synagogue security guard, who, as I was walking to synagogue on Simchas Torah, which is the last day of Sukkot here in America, it's the last day of a Jewish holiday of booths, the Tabernacles Festival, where he said, "I got to talk to you right now." And he said, "You're not going to believe what's happening in Israel. You have a big event tonight for the synagogue. We need to talk about this right now." And he told me what was unfolding in Israel. And when he told me, I couldn't believe it. I figured it was something that was lost in translation. And as it unfolded, we heard more and more how bad it was. Earlier this week, there was a screening for the media in Seattle of the October 7th footage that Hamas themselves took. And I quote this all the time, but the Babylon Bee, which is a parody website, had a headline that said, "Hamas terrorists disappointed that nobody believes them after they went to all the trouble to live stream their atrocities." And what's crazy to me is we are literally watching Holocaust denial in real time. And it's only been 8 weeks. It's only been 8 weeks since this all started. And we're literally watching it in real time. Zaka is an organization which went in and dealt with what happened after. Their recovery operation, their rescue operation. They saw what happened after. I'm very fortunate that some of my old friends, some of my new friends, are the ones who went in and did this. So we can hear from them firsthand what they saw. Joining us now, Jesse Vogel, Michael Leder, John Shetrit, Isaac Stern. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us again.
So let's start with Micha. Micha, you get there. You have an idea what you're heading into. What did you see that you didn't expect? You get there, you go there. And I'm sure you guys were like, okay, we know it's bad, but we didn't know it was this bad. What's the first thing you saw when you walked in?
Let me just talk about it for a second, how it was when we landed. We'd be up at 6 o'clock in the morning. And John's driving. It takes about 2 hours to get there from Jerusalem to where we had to go to for the first day, Sukkim. You get pulled up to a gas station and you line up. Now there's this air of, I don't know, stillness. I mean, it was only at that point, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks after it happened. And you have to line up in a convoy with, you know, there's a couple of military cars in front of you, behind you, and then there's about 10 or 15 cars behind you and a couple trucks, and we're driving through. John, the one thing that I kept on talking to John about, because I've done something similar to this before where Isaac and I helped out at Surfside. There's a smell in the air that hits you. And that's for weeks afterwards. And when I came back from Surfside, I couldn't take the garbage out. It was, you know, that smell sticks with you for a long time. That was me being nervous at that point. John looks at me and he sees me turn white. He's like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "No, I was not okay." As soon as we crossed that checkpoint, I was not okay.
So let me ask you this before you go any further, Micha. We all lived in New York after 9/11, and there was a smell in the subways in Manhattan. I will never forget that smell as long as I live. It smelled like a barbecue that went wrong. Is that the smell, or was it something else?
Something completely different. It's I don't know, a sweet smell. There's a smell, and you know, and you, that association, you know what it is. It's not like going to a funeral home or
it smells like a decomposing body.
That's the scare for me, at least, because that association it sticks with you for a long, long time afterwards. John looks at me and he's like, "Are you okay?" And I had to turn to him. No, it was just the coffee, but I was terrified. We finally get to Sufim and you cross this line, you feel everything's different. There's, you see the smoke from Gaza because you're right there. You're you know, driving through desert land. There's cars that are burnt out everywhere, or places where cars used to be that were burnt out everywhere. You could tell that there was something that happened there. The deeper you move in, the more you see it. It was surreal. It was surreal. We were right in the middle of a war zone. I mean, we thought we heard stuff that we weren't sure. At that point, we didn't know exactly what it was, but you hear bombs going off. You hear missiles being fired. We finally get to Sufim, and there's a helicopter above us that's shooting rockets. I mean, it was a surreal moment. We line up to start talking and give us a briefing, and all of a sudden the shots ring out, and there was some guy, some terrorist who had, I guess he was left over or somehow broke in again, and he was, you know, a few hundred yards from us. You know, they just killed this terrorist because he broke into the Sufim again. It was something that I'll never forget. And there was that smell that was there, but you know, you kind of, it's a weird thing. You pull in and they have these bomb shelters and there's Sesame Street characters painted all over them. Everything is geared towards kids, but there's nothing there. There's nothing going on. There's playgrounds, there's open field. You'd expect it to be, you know, beautiful. There's nothing going on. It was just, you see army vehicles and soldiers walking around and then just the smell of death. I mean, that's really what our introduction. I mean, it goes even further than that, but I'll let these guys tell you about how what happened afterwards.
So, Isaac, you smelled the same thing. You're describing the same thing. You're helping Micha out. I mean, what sticks with you most? You mean, you guys are heading in there. Just to clarify a few things Micha said, a lot of the bomb shelters in Israel decorate for kids so the kids feel at home. My son right now is actually raising money for a bomb shelter to help out a former student of mine who's now trying to make a nursery in a bomb shelter. That's life there, unfortunately, right now since the war began. But you're going to a place where nobody's left, where everybody has evacuated or everybody's been killed or whatever the case may be. Isaac, what sticks with you?
So the smell of death is something. I was with Micha in Surfside. We knew what that smelled like when bodies are rotting.
You mean after Katrina?
No, when Surfside, when the building collapsed.
Oh, in Florida. In Florida.
Yeah, Florida, yeah.
Florida, yeah.
So, you know, there's bodies in 80 degrees because that's the weather there in the south. And you smell the death. You smell the body. You just don't see them right away, but you smell them. And you're walking into a scene where all there is you're on the ground, you're walking, is just thousands of casings of bullets. And the houses are all bullet ridden. The cars are bullet ridden. The houses are grenade ridden. There's, you know, a lot of magazines from guns that they use, just they were switching out and just threw down the magazine for the next one. You could see it was a war zone. You could see that they tore that place apart. Houses they couldn't get into, they lit on fire so the people inside would burn. When we got into the houses, the first house we went into was a grenade house. Like Jesse said, it's a Rimon house. They call it a Rimon. It's a grenade in Israel.
Frag grenade.
Yeah. So you walk in there, and you know what you're going to see because you heard about it. But when you see it, it's a whole different story, because knowing what it looks like and actually experiencing it is two different worlds. And we're climbing on top of closets. I'm finding someone's hair with their skin still attached to it from their scalp. And then on the floor, we're scooping up, like, it's almost like Sloppy Joe. It's blood mixed with guts and skin and tissue. And these people were brutally murdered in their homes. We found teeth, you know, we found teeth, you know, in one of the cars we're looking at, someone's head was there. Their head rotted away, so their skull was left. Their vertebrae was there. I mean, these people were mortared and chopped up into pieces. And the first people who went in was the army to basically get rid of all the, because they used to put grenades under the people so that when you flip them over, it would blow up in your face. So the army had to clear out the bombs and all that. And the grenades. Zaka went and pulled out the bodies, and then we came. So we came into a fresh home that was just blood, guts, and body parts that they hadn't got to yet. And there's no denying that. You know what I'm saying? There's no, it's just there right in front of you. And you couldn't even make it a movie set if you wanted to.
So then, Jesse, I'll ask you this. There's something I saw in the October 7th footage that has haunted me. There's four scenes in particular that haunted me, but one of the four scenes is they come to the Nova Festival, and there's a big concession stand. I mean, it's the one you see at massive festivals, not a tiny little concession stand like in a sports stadium. It's a massive one. And they come there, and you see the Coca-Cola logo, you see the beer kegs, you see all the stuff you would see at a festival. But the entire floor is littered with bodies. In fact, I can't see the floor. You just see the bodies. And I'm looking at this, and the guy from the Israeli army, as Isaac just described, who's coming in, Tein li siman chayim, give me a sign of life. Show me somebody's alive. It reminded me of the movie Titanic, even though we know Titanic's based on a real story, and this thing actually happened where the guy in the lifeboat is saying, is anybody alive out there? That's basically the equivalent of what was happening. And everybody's dead, and he admits that everybody's dead. So when you're walking into this place, Zaka does the recovery, because in Jewish tradition, we believe bodies have to be buried intact. Every part of the body has to be buried as much as it can be. You got to put it all on the ground. You got to recover everything. You're going in there. You're doing this. What are you thinking? What are you feeling? What are you seeing?
That is a very, very loaded question. I mean, it's kind of... The best way I can explain it is similar to some of the things that they have said already, is that it seems like there's silence, but it's not. We're hearing artillery going off. We're hearing helicopters. We're hearing rockets. We're hearing all sorts of wartime noises. Yet it kind of seems like when you're in a pool and you submerge your head, and all of a sudden, all the noise goes away, and it kind of muffled in the background because you're focused on what you're there to do. Every once in a while, it's like you pull your head out of the water, and everything is at full volume. At least that's the way I explain. I felt it. It's very difficult to explain. Anyone want to?
If I interject for a second, Zaka actually is search, rescue, and then recovery. So when they came to the scene right away, they came when they were still being shot at on October 7th, about 11 a.m., they started going to the scene. They are, 90% of them are trained EMTs. So they're first trying to save lives. And then, of course, when they can't, they do recovery. Even after everything was gone, the fields... You just felt people's unrested souls there. There was stuff scattered all over the place. You know, people were in the middle of drinking, middle of having their lunch, their sandwiches were on the ground. And, you know, they just were trying to have a peaceful time together. And wherever they went, they just got shot. They tried going in their car, they got shot in their car. Wherever they ran, they were just getting killed.
John, looking at what you saw, what these guys are describing, what you've described to me before we started the interview, it sounds like such barbarous vindictiveness. It seems like it's more than hate. It seems like it's, I don't know the word for it. Despise isn't even a strong enough word. When you saw what you saw, this isn't how normal human beings behave. What did you see?
It's crazy, Ari. You know, as I'm sitting here and I'm reminiscing and I'm listening to my boys just going through what happened, it's like all my feelings are coming back. You know, like when you're speeding 90 miles an hour on the highway, you got two hands on the steering wheel, your eyes are laser focused, and you're in a super hypertension, you know, fight or flight. And you're all in, and your tension's so high, you're in this insane state that you can't really stay in for too long. And I'm starting to feel it back, because when we were there, all of our emotions, our tensions, eyes dilated. You hear a war. You don't just hear bombs. Your organs are vibrating in ways that you've never felt before. Your lungs are exploding with every bomb that goes off. You're feeling such dread, terror. Forget the sickly sweet death that's coming into our minds. And there's this nauseating feeling that we've been in for the entire day. Your overactive senses, our senses are overactive with so much input. Each one of these details is enough to traumatize a normal person for a lifetime. And, you know, while we're searching for body parts in the house, we hear a red alert go on, which means a bomb's coming, and you have 3 seconds, and we're diving on the floor while searching for dead bodies, while smelling death, expecting a bomb to blow our legs off in any second. And if the bomb goes off and the whole world shakes and we don't die, we get right back up and we get back to work. And there's so much tension and there's so many emotions, and we're laser focused. So you're feeling, and I'm feeling it now. I'm feeling my fingertips are buzzing, you know, my nausea is coming back a little bit. And you're asking me about the feeling. I'll tell you something, Ari, listen, as a Jew and as a human, but especially as a Jew, we're trained to constantly think of other people, to be selfless, to be kind, to try to represent, try to be a little bit better. And I always try to see, I work with people for a living. So I do. I try to build the best out of people. And I always feel like people are good. I believe people are good. And there's no such thing as pure evil. That's why, you know, it's hard to believe. But when we were there, Ari, it's the first time in my life that I actually experienced pure, 100% pure evil in a way that it's so sick. It's just so sick when you're pulling out a piece of flesh off a little tiny girl's shoe. This girl's shoe maybe would have been 1 year old, and you're pulling the flesh off. You feel such a sickness. There's not one DNA strand in my brain that can understand how a person could be so evil. It's not a conflict. There's not a I do to you and you do to me. I would never in a billion years ever have the ability to hurt someone the way these people hurt us. And you're overcome with such anger and such sickness. It's just, it's something that we're not trained for this. We're not trained to experience such evil ever. Even I heard an Israeli soldier say, when he saw a bunch of Thailandi bodies piled up, farmers from Thailand that have no clue about Israel versus Palestine. They never heard of it, the conflict. They don't know anything about history. They just want a job. And when the soldier saw piled up bodies of Thailandis dead, he himself was shocked. He realized then that we're not talking about normal humans here. We're not talking about someone that has an agenda. They just want death, destruction, and evil. They just want to get and destroy as much as possible. And that's the feeling. You're in a house. You see avocados. There's a birthday cake on a table. One of the boys that we were with told us there's a birthday cake. And he goes in. So he's looking around. He doesn't see anybody. It must have been in the middle of a birthday party. And he goes into the bomb shelter and he finds an entire family burnt to death, holding hands, embracing. They were in the middle of a birthday party. They ran into the bomb shelter. And these monsters they lit the bomb shelter on fire because they couldn't get in. And these people had to embrace each other while they were slowly burning alive. And when our friend had to go and pull these bodies apart, he said he smelled something so wicked, like you said. The barbecue gone wrong is the best way to put it. And he pulls these people apart and he puts them in a bag and he carries them out. And as he carries them out, he looks on the fridge and he sees pictures of the family that he's holding, but not burnt and rotten, but smiling, beautiful hair, beautiful girls, beautiful kids, beautiful men, just trying to have a birthday party. They don't know anything. Little kid, little birthday cake. And this is what we're dealing with. And while this is happening, we feel constant bombs that they're throwing rockets towards us to kill with no direction, no aim. They don't give a damn. There's no infrared missiles here. We're talking about these morons taking water pipes from the ground, sticking bombs in there and blowing any direction. Wherever it hits, it could hit. It could hit a family. It could hit a temple, a church. It could hit a mosque. It could hit an Arab. It could hit a Jew. It could hit an American tourist. It could hit a guy who's just trying to help bury some people off the ground. They don't care. No discrimination. So you're trying to ask us to describe words and emotions that to this day, every single one of us are processing. I don't realize how much denial I'm in until we have these conversations and it comes back and you realize how much work there is to do. But this is just a little glimpse into the world we're living in right now.
So one of the things, and you guys have seen it firsthand, don't watch the footage. Jesse had thought I had seen it the week before, and he asked me how I was doing, and I was blown away by that. Like, you saw all of it for person. I saw it on film, and I couldn't believe you were asking me how I was doing. One thing that I saw from this was just that they were doing it with such glee, Micha. And when you're looking at this stuff, when you're looking at this barbarism, how do you feel when you're confronted with the evil we were raised about hearing about in school, but it was hard for us to comprehend? Did it bring back any of that kind of stuff you're hearing in school about the Nazis or anything else? Or you go, this is on a whole nother level by itself.
This is something that I don't know. I wasn't there when the Nazis did what they did. I don't know. I think that they were, you know, Germans in general are pretty, you know, the ones that I know are very nice people. And they're upstanding to a degree. I don't think that they took glee in what they were doing, the regular soldier on the street. I don't think that they did. I mean, I think that they were given an order for some of them, whether they had the choice to do it or not, I don't know. But from the videos that I saw and the things that I saw there, they were all too happy. They were laughing, calling back home to their parents and saying, look what I did. I killed a Jew. I mean, they were proud of it. This is something that's beyond comprehension. I mean, I don't know how a person can kill a child and be happy about it. Kill an innocent. I mean, the places that they went, we're not talking about they were going to the West Bank to kill settlers, right? Settlers they feel are taking over their land. These are people who've been living there for the last 70 years, and they used to go into Gaza to the crossing and bring kids over to go to the hospital, to go to doctors. These were the people who were on the so far on the left that they were helping these people out. I mean, one of them was a woman that they killed, that they took back. She would go to the crossing and take kids to the hospital. She would take responsibility for them. And they went into the same place and killed them. The reason why they knew where to go is because they had these Arab workers who would come in from Gaza, and they would treat them well. They would give them food. They would work in the fields. I mean, these were people who worked with them day in and day out. They gave them, these Arabs who came in, or these Gazans who came in at least, gave them maps back to Hamas and told them this person was here, this person was here, they're home, they're not home, so on and so forth. I don't know how. I mean, I would think that certain people, you would call them a friend to a certain degree, especially if you've been, you know, dealing with them for years. How you can go in and just kill everyone with that, it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think that's going to explain.
Isaac, we grew up with these stories about, you know, Nazis who knew the Jews from the town, like the Commandant or something like that, saving people. It seems like there was no mercy here at all. It was just massacre anybody who's in front of you. Like Mikla said, these guys had work permits. They had worked with these people. They knew these people, and there was no mercy. It was just let's massacre everybody.
Yeah, it's, I don't know how it's possible as a human. I mean, these families told me that I you know, they came back at some point, you know, towards the end of our trip to the kibbutz, some of them that were alive, to see what was left of their homes. They said that they used to give gifts to these workers to take to their children in Gaza. And these are the same people who came back to murder them. And they went into the house and said, where's Nior? Where's, you know, they called their kids by their names. Where are they so we could murder them? You know, I don't know how someone could be so nice to you and you could still have such evilness. I mean, they raped these women who did so much good for them. After they raped them, they desecrated their bodies. You know, when I was scooping up the stuff, you know, the stories I heard was they cut off their, you know, breasts and vaginas. And when I was scooping up stuff, like, I felt like that's what you were scooping up. I mean, I know it's very intense and very crazy, the stuff I'm saying, but this is what they did. I mean, there's no words or understanding that could explain this stuff except pure, pure evil. They're the devils.
Before we run out of time here, Jesse, I mean, I'm looking at this kind of stuff. Are you guys getting, I guess, the help you need after this? I mean, a normal person taking on all this kind of stuff, this is pretty intense, the stuff you're describing. I mean, people said to me, are you going to see somebody after I saw the footage? You guys saw it for real. What are you guys doing?
I know I personally spoke to a trauma therapist, and I'm working through it. But the interesting thing is I don't necessarily want to work through all of it, because The second that you go numb on something, they've won. They've taken a part of you. Like, I still have the app on my phone called Red Alert, that every time the Iron Dome goes off, I get an alert of where it is. Now, I'm already back in America. I'm not there. Why would I want that? Because those are my brothers and my sisters, and I should feel that pain. A lot of people think you get over something. You shouldn't get over everything. Like, when I'm walking in the street, and I, by mistake, when I'm walking my dog at 5:20 in the morning before I go to work, and I kick a piece of glass that I didn't see, and I hear the shard just bouncing, in my head, I remember being back in Kisufim, where everyone was murdered by these animals. And when you're walking on the ground, you're literally stepping on spent shell casings. But like when I was playing with my daughter before, earlier today on our Sabbath, we were playing with a Fisher-Price toy, and I realized that I cleaned the blood of a Jewish kid off of that same toy elephant when I was in Kisufim. So there's definitely a lot to be worked through, but I feel like if we can't get rid of our sensitivity to this, because the second that we do, it's negating what happened. So we can work through it to a point, but we still have to carry some of that with us. Otherwise, who's going to remember to tell these stories? Who's going to remember to explain this to other people?
John, we only got 2 minutes left. Before I let you guys go, people call my show all the time and they say, Ari, why do people hate Jews? And I've had various reasons for why that is, but you've seen the absolute violence and barbarity. And I can't even name enough descriptions of this. If somebody asked you that question, what would you say?
The million-dollar question, Ari. Why does everybody hate Jews? This is the answer that I believe. There are three main characters in every story. Every good movie has three main characters. We got the villain, we got the hero, and we got the victim. Now, we have the same thing in our life. It's very hard to be the hero. We all know we're not the hero. We don't want to be the villain. So who's left? We play victim. We all do it. With childhood, my mother, my father, when I was a kid, my school, all the hardships we went through, and we hold on to those excuses for life, and it helps us. So whatever we don't accomplish, we just blame on our victimhood. And the whole world is filled with victims. Look online. Look away. Every day. Self-care day. Self-care day. I have to go to work from 9 to 5. I have to spend the rest of the week doing self-care. You see, Jews, we are the most tragic story in history. We've been thrown out of Spain, thrown out of Egypt, thrown out of Babylon, Persia. The Greeks killed us. The Romans killed us. We've been raped, murdered, slaughtered. Germany destroyed every single family member. 6 million of our people killed us, gassed us, tore our families apart, murdered us. And we come to the desert. We come to America with nothing. Nothing but trauma and sadness. We feel forsaken by God and by our people. And we should hold on to that victim story more than anybody in the world. And we don't. We refuse because we're Jews. We got a burning soul inside us. We're people of God. And we refuse to give up. We fight every day. Every damn day. We want to be the best because the world needs so much work. We want to produce. We want to give you guys brains. We want to be the best people in EMTs and doctors. We want to give you guys, how many prizes have we won? We want to give you guys brains in computers. And we want to be the best, hardest working in the room. And we want to be successful. We don't want to cry. We don't want to cry victim our whole life. So look around. We don't give up. We refuse to give in. We keep fighting and we keep pushing. And guess what happens? Every damn time a Jew walks into the room, I feel uncomfortable. All the people in the room feel uncomfortable. You know why? Because no more excuses. Look at that damn Jew. I could either be inspired by the Jew who refuses to give in, and I can extra work extra hard just like them, or I could just hate them and convince myself that they're sick monsters, so I don't have to do the work. It's much easier to hate the Jew than to do the work, Ari.
Jesse Vogel, Michal Leiter, John Shetrit, Isaac Stern. Thank you so much for being with us, guys. If you want to donate, you can go to donate@rockawaypatrol.com. That's donate@rockawaypatrol to help out the amazing
work
of Zaka. .org. Sorry. Donate@rockawaypatrol.org. Donate@rockawaypatrol.org. This gentleman from Zaka, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.